Let's pray. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this text. Thank you for Genesis and the amazing theology that it contains and that it teaches us. The Torah is an instructor, a pointer, a teacher, somebody or something that points us to the principles of our lives that we need to live by, and ultimately through those points us to Christ and the fact that He is the one who fulfills this. He's the one who is the end of this, the goal of this. And so as we study this, help us to keep Him in mind and just give us clarity of thought and give me strength, Lord. In your name we pray. Amen. So Cha filled in 2 weeks ago, and Long did last week, so it's been a couple weeks. So just wanted to start out with just a little bit of review. Thank you for both of those. Cha's filling in was kind of unexpected because I got sick. Thank you for filling in. And then Long, it was really great to have him teach on what the gospel was. And so now we're back in Genesis. By way of review, I'm not going to do extensive review here, but there's just kind of two things that I want to mention. Our beginnings inform who we are and what our responsibilities are. Perfect example. In 2 days, we're going to have an election, and you have a moral responsibility as an American citizen to go out and cast a vote for a candidate because of the way that our country was founded. We did not start out as a free country who was independent from England and from the tyranny of taxation without representation, and the fact that that is our background, that's our history, that really comes to inform our moral duties that we have as citizens of this country. If we really appreciate our beginnings, if we really appreciate where we start out from, it informs how we look at our responsibility to vote or to get involved in the community or to, you know, defend liberty or freedom or speak out on things that are wrong or exercise our rights. There's almost kind of a moral obligation to do that. Well, the same thing is true with the book of Genesis. The Genesis just means beginning. That's not the Hebrew word, but even in the Hebrew word of the book is Bereshit, in the beginning. It's the first word of the book, which gets translated through Latin to mean Genesis, which in English means the beginning. So Genesis is the beginning of everything, and Genesis 1 is the beginning of the beginning of everything. And so it's not told to us just to scratch the itch of curiosity, but to actually inform our duty and to set a context for how we are to relate to God and how we are to relate to each other. So that's why Moses is telling us this story. He's setting up our understanding of the world, of the universe, and of God's relationship to it in God's relationship to us and how all those relationships play out so that we have the framework, the structure within which we can understand what's to come, which is in the law. So that's the first thing. Well, then the second thing would be, so then what is the main thing that he's trying to communicate here in Genesis 1? And I'd say that the main thing is that he's trying to communicate is that God is the sovereign creator of the universe who creates a good land, a good world within which he puts mankind as his image. Yeah, you could think about it like God is setting up his kingdom. He's building his kingdom by actually creating it out of nothing. And then he takes a vice ruler, a vice regent, and he puts it in the kingdom and says, okay, exercise authority over my kingdom on my behalf. And that's kind of what's wrapped up in being the image of God, and we're going to get to that today. So that's kind of where all of this is going. you definitely have the structure of Genesis chapter 1 is in those two terms, tohu wabohu, without form and void. It's formless and empty is the idea. Formless not in the sense that it's chaotic, because there's nothing evil about this creation, but formless in the sense that it's like a lump of the potter's clay on the wheel before he does anything with it. It's just, it's not shaped yet. So days 1, 2, and 3 are God forming what has no form, forming the formless. And then it's empty, it's void, in the sense that it doesn't have anything alive in it. Not that everything's dead, it's just that there's nothing that has been created which is alive. So he takes what he's formed and he fills it. So he's forming the formless and he's filling the empty. And that's the structure of the book, and I think Moses is very intentionally communicating that in verse 2 there. The earth was without form and void. we got through day 1, which is in verse 3. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and God saw that it was good. God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, the darkness night, and there was evening, the morning, and there was morning the first day. And that brings us up to day 2. Now, what is like the focus of day 2, just from reading it? Does somebody want to read verses 6 through 8?
"And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day."
All right. So what's the focus of this day? If you could summarize it in one word.
The distinction of the space and the earth, water?
Yeah, I think water would be the right idea. And there's waters, basically they're saying there's waters up there and there's waters down here. And he creates the expanse. Now the expanse is the word rakia. Sometimes, I mean, those of us who have studied this and who are interested in the beginnings have come across this word. And sometimes you get the idea of like a canopy theory, right? Where the water used to be covered with this canopy of water. I actually don't think that that's true, mostly because the rakia, whatever it is still up there. That's because Psalm 104 verse 3, Psalm 147 verse 8, and Psalm 148 verse 4 all mention it as something that is up there right now. So I'll just read just Psalm 104 verse 3. Just listen. "He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters. He makes his clouds his chariot, and he rides on the wings of the the wind." That might not have been the right one. 147 verse 8. He covers the heavens with clouds, and he prepares the rain for the earth, and he makes the grass grow. So I think that word clouds, he covers the heavens with an expanse. It's talked about in the present tense. So whatever it is, it's still up there. So I don't think it was a canopy of water that broke and came down and necessarily and flooded the earth. I think that the flood is understood in different terms of rain, and then the water's coming up from the deep. But it's water. So it's the creation of the water. Now remember, one of the themes that runs through this chapter is good. God saw that it was good. Now, what does it mean? What does good mean in this context? Do you remember what I said a couple weeks ago?
Profitable for the habitation of man.
Yes. Good for the habitation of man. Now, the reason why I know that is because there is no place in this particular day, day 2, that says he saw that it was good. He doesn't see anything as good in day 2. It was just he said, "Let there be," verse 7, "and God made the expanse, and it was so, and God names it, and there was evening and there was morning the second day," but there's no evaluation, which there normally is. Well, that's because good is understood to be beneficial for mankind. You can't live as mankind in the sea. And then it's not until you get to day three, the next day, where you actually have two evaluations that it's good. So one in verse 10, and God saw that it was good, and then another in verse 12, and God saw that it was good. It's not until he separates the waters and the dry land that he says it's good, it's beneficial, and then sprouting vegetation, and specifically vegetation that is designed for the nourishment of humankind. He says it's good. So the waters and the heavens. There's another important feature that kind of goes through here that I want to mention at this day. You see in verse six, it says, "And God said," and then you see in verse 7, "And God made." So you have two different ways that this action of God is being presented in each of the days. This happens multiple times throughout the story. You have the speaking of God, and then you have the making of God. There's a speech, and then there's an act. It's not as though he speaks, and then nothing happens, so he has to get in and do it. Okay, so this is the one act viewed from two different angles. It's the actual report of what happened. "And God said, let there be." And in that moment, there was, you know, and it was so. But it's described in verse 7 as, "And God made the expanse." And the point of pointing that out, remember there's a polemical thing running through here. This is like a refutation of other creation accounts just by telling the truth. His point of saying, "And God made," is to say, "And God made the heavens and the earth. He made it, nobody else. And he did it by his word." So that's how you get that, God said, and then God made, the pairing. Yes?
There is a little number next to the word made, so I checked to see, and it said another way to say it is fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
So would it also just be the distinction between, like, he created it and then from it fashioned something out of it, just in the same way that he did with the formless void earth?
Kind of, but the only problem is that there's an exact correspondence between what God says and what God makes.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, like in verse 6, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate waters from the waters." And then verse 7, you have exactly that being made. "And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse, and it was so." It's like a report of what happened, and then the author's interpretation of that report. It's like Moses saying, "This is what God actually said,"
mm-hmm.
"and this is what that means. You know, he made it." And the point of that is to reemphasize, God did this, nobody else.
So my understanding of what you just said is that verse 7 would say that it's not God actually physically made, but he spoke into existence, because verse 6.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's one act viewed from just two different viewpoints. And that's confirmed by the New Testament, which says that we believe by faith that God made the world by his word, mm-hmm. right? And that's in Hebrews. So, okay, let's move on to day two here, or sorry, day three. So what's the focus of this? Somebody read verses 9 through 13.
"And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, according to its kind. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and morning the third day."
So the problem was, as we mentioned, it was water, right? You need to have land for people to live there. Notice it says, "Let the dry land appear." This is the same word that's used in the Exodus, where the waters part and the people of God walk across on dry land. So that's actually a tip of the hat that Moses is doing in Exodus back to Genesis chapter 2, where he says he prepares the land for the habitation of man by parting the waters and making the dry land appear. Well, he's doing the same thing in the Exodus, where he parts the waters, the dry land appears, so that they can go into the land. So the fact that he uses the word, you know, the waters under the heavens be gathered into one place, and the dry land appeared, and then in verse 10, he says, and he called the dry land earth. Earth is Eretz, which is the same word that's used to describe the land of Canaan. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of like setup for the Israelites' understanding of what is the land of Canaan. Well, it's supposed to be what the land always was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be the little microcosm of kind of redeemed earth, where the people of God would live on that redeemed earth in perfect relationship with him. Which comes back to Genesis. So the nation of Israel is basically a giant nation saying, we stand for the way God made things in the beginning, which comes into the church, right? And that's actually, again, that's the laying the foundation for the Torah, for us to understand why God gives us the commands that he gives us. So the problem is water, and it needs to be separated from the land in order for the land to become habitable. But the dry land is not, it not only appears, but it's also filled with food for humanity. So let the earth sprout, verse 11, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants. So vegetation is like the umbrella term, and underneath the word vegetation is the word plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit in which there is their seed. So you have, it's two plants being talked about. Now, are those the only two plants that God created? No. So why does he single out these two plants?
They're both used as illustrations later in the New Testament.
Okay.
And in the Old Testament.
Explain.
Well, there's the entire imagery of the seed, the promised seed. And then, you know, I think of the parables where he talks about the different types of seeds. Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, the fruit in Genesis. But then there's also the imagery in the New Testament of bearing fruit, and the fruit will tell you, you know, what kind of tree it is.
Yes, that's all of those are excellent things that are like, yeah, way down the line,
yeah.
That is exactly where it ends up, and that's really perceptive because that means that you're getting the point, you know, where this is actually starting a trajectory to lead towards those things. He's intelligent, you know. He's, and you know, also God, you know, is inspiring this. So there's a couple of things. So let me kind of put that in a couple bullet points for us. First of all, plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit. What do you do with seed and fruit?
Plant and eat it.
You eat it, right? Well, you plant seed and you eat fruit,
mm-hmm.
And in the fruit it has seed that you plant. So, first of all, you have the idea of food for man, which is why it's good, because man can't survive without food.
Right.
But then you also have the idea of seed introduced here. Now, what do you do with seed? You plant it. And part of Adam's coming responsibility is to do what to the garden? There's two words.
Cultivate.
Work and keep.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, to till and to maintain. Well, what does he use to till? Well, he's gonna plant seed in the ground that he tills, right? So this is setting up for man's for an understanding of work and for an understanding of how man is actually supposed to be sustained. This is also the beginning of the theology of the seed. Now, the only thing that's really mentioned about the seed here is that each is according to its kind. That seed bears like, right? And that's where Jesus goes with it. He says, you will know them by their fruit, because fruit is according to the kind of tree that it is, which comes back to here. And it says specifically that it was on the earth, which is also really interesting, to just solidify this is on the earth, this is pointed towards the land specifically. There's a very strong connection with Eden, because what kind of plants does God cause to grow in Eden? Go to verse 9 of chapter 2, and somebody read verse 9.
out of the ground the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
So you have trees. That's like the only thing that's mentioned about the garden is trees. Well, that harkens back to day three. So good. That's all I really wanted to say from day three. I need to keep up the pace. I think we're doing okay. Day four, heavenly bodies. Somebody read verses 14 through 19.
And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, for the days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day.
Good. So main idea here is what?
Day and night.
Lights. Basically, right? So you've remember days. Remember the outline of the passage. So one, two, and three are forming the formless. He now has formed the formless. He has shaped the world so that now it's inhabitable. Now he's going to fill what's empty. He has a habitat, and now he needs to fill the habitat. He's creating the terrarium, and now he needs to actually put the lizards in the terrarium, right? So the first thing that he fills is what he created on day one. So day four corresponds to day one. This is a very common feature that you hear pointed out. Day four is the lights and what was created on day one. Not the heavens and the earth, but it's in verse three.
Let there be light.
Let there be light. So light and darkness was created. So the habitat of light, habitat of darkness is now filled with the sun and the moon, or what he calls the greater and the lesser lights, right? And that's because there's polemics here. Again, sun and moon are associated with pagan worship, so he doesn't say the sun and the moon and the stars. He says the light that's greater and the light that's lesser, because he's trying to say to the other pagan nations, hey, look, like, what you worship is just a thing. You know, it is made by my God, you know, and the implication is you need to worship that God. Plus, there's kind of an irony here that's happening, because what's the reason why he creates these lights in the first place? It's in the second half of verse 14.
The signs for the seasons?
Signs and seasons for days and years. Who keeps track of signs and seasons and days and years?
People.
People, you know, humankind, right? Not the creation. So basically what he's saying is the lights were designed to serve who?
Man.
Man. And now you're going to turn around and serve the lights. You're reversing the order of creation here. And that actually happens very explicitly in Genesis 3, but we'll get there when we get there.
Doesn't the word for separate to mean sort of like to distinguish between?
Yes. Separate isn't like tearing apart. Separating is making a distinction. Just like the Israelites made a distinction between what was holy and what was not holy, or what was clean and what was unclean, that's the same word that's used here. He's not like tearing apart the sun and the moon or tearing apart the light and the darkness. He's just saying this is light and this is darkness. He's bringing order and then he's attaching that. A lot of people say this can't be a literal account, because you had light on day one, but then you didn't have anything to give light until day four. I don't see how that's an issue, because first of all,
like that in the not the Millennial Kingdom, but in
the new heavens and the new earth,
at least in Jerusalem,
it does say there was no need for the sun, but it says that the city itself gave off such a light that it wasn't necessary. It doesn't say that there's no sun necessarily, mm-hmm. but it does say that there's other light. There's another source of light. You don't need to have a sun in order to have light. And that's actually an echo of this passage here, this idea of there's a light without a light giver. Well, the light, because the light giver is God.
God.
Yeah. So it's not hard to reconcile the fact that there can be light without a sun. Because light, you could say light wasn't attached to anything yet, or God, it was emanating from God, or any number of things, which makes perfect sense out of it and still allows us to interpret it as literal. Plus, you got to understand, God's like making the world, so like the laws of physics aren't necessarily established yet, and he's actually working these things out in detail. Then the idea of the other thing that I want to mention from this, and again, there's always, we could go into every word and trace it and just go everywhere, but the idea of rulership is introduced for the first time here in verse 16. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. So you have the idea that there are certain things that have a certain domain, and that domain belongs to that thing. And who gives that domain?
God.
He makes the light in order to rule, and he gives the light the responsibility to rule, and they actually, accomplish that responsibility. He sets them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. Again, you have the emphasis on the earth is not necessarily on the heavens here, but it's on the earth. And they rule over the day and the night. God saw that it was good. There was evening, there was morning, the fourth day. Day five. Okay, I want to spend most of the time on day six and seven because that's where most of the good stuff is here. But again, like we could spend weeks just going through this one chapter. I want to get the overview of this. Somebody read verses 20 through 23. Suzanne, go ahead.
And God said, 20-23.
Yeah.
And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day.
Okay, so what's the like word that can summarize this day?
Born?
Or,
Creatures, animals?
Yeah, creatures, animals, specifically what kind?
Sea and sky.
Sea and sky, right? And that corresponds to what day? Day. One corresponded to four, so two would correspond to?
Five.
So, and what was created on day two? The expanse of the heavens, up there and down here, right? So you have the sky where the air creatures are, and you have the sea where the sea creatures are. So God is filling the formed. So you have the birds and the creatures. He is... this marks a brand new stage in the creative process of God. Okay, so he's doing something that he's never done before, which is the creation of living creatures. Living creatures. And there's actually a really interesting grammatical thing that's happening here. So in verse 21, it says, so God, and what's the word that he uses?
Created.
Where is that word used?
In verse 1,
right? And now that's a different word than, for instance, God, verse 16, and God made or fashioned. And again, up in verse 7, and God made, right? So this is a different word. This is the word bara, and it's reserved specifically for when God begins a new stage in his creation. It also occurs again when he says in verse 27, so God created man in his own image. The new stage in the creation is the creation of his own image, and it's reserved until that moment. And then again, he uses it in verse chapter 2, verse 3, so God blessed the seventh day, made it holy, because on it God rested from his work that he had done in creation. So, and that's the stage of, it's all done. It's all done now. So this is a brand new stage. There are living creatures that never existed before. It's interesting that he doesn't give much detail about these creatures. He creates the giant sea creatures. These are like Leviathan and just like, again, this is the polemics of saying like, you know, you, the things that you worship and the things that you're afraid of, first of all, they're just creatures. And second of all, God made them. My God made them. And therefore he owns them and he created them for his own glory. And every living creature that moves in the waters. And then what's the phrase that's repeated in verse 21 after each the description of each creature?
According to its kind.
According to their kind. And you heard that again back when he created trees.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting to see a theme here. Now we're going to mention that theme in just a second, so just note it and let's move on. God saw that it was good, and this is a new element again, blessing. So you have the first time that blessing is given. A blessing is basically something where it takes what is good and it augments it and basically says, perfectly enjoy my good creation. It's only given to living beings, only given to the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the beasts, and then mankind. And it's always related to childbearing, to being fruitful and multiply and filling the earth. So you have the blessing, and you have the implied theme of the seed being joined together. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the seed, and that seed is the product of the blessing of God on that person. And that always happens on the earth, as it says in verse 22, right at the end there. I let the birds multiply on the earth. It has very little to do with the fact that that's where they multiply. It has everything to do with a theological point of saying it happens in the land, and that's where the blessing happens, and that's where the multiplication happens. And there was evening, there was morning, the fifth day. So, okay, let's get on to day 6 here. Now, somebody read basically the rest of the chapter, 24 all the way to 31.
Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle, and creeping thing, and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on them.
Here's some results from the web.
Oh my goodness, sorry. and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day.
Great. So you have two acts of creation here. The first time he creates the livestock and creeping things, so land animals is the idea, and he creates man. Two acts of creation. Day 6 corresponds with day
3,
in which what was created?
The land.
The land. And?
The
vegetation, right? And you have both here. So the land animals, and then the land animals eat the vegetation. Yeah. It's very, very structured. It's very specific. In fact, it's so structured that a lot of people are like, ah, it can't have happened that way. It's so perfect that people are like, this isn't even possible. But it is possible because our God is that good. Livestock, creeping things, the beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And also, like, what you should be hearing in that is this is a perfect creation. This is just perfect. Everything is perfect. Everything is idyllic. It's ideal. It's wonderful. There's nothing wrong with it. It's good. In fact, he's going to say it's very good. And part of that is shown by the way that it's all organized. It's all laid out in a particular way. Even the process that God took in order to actually get to that perfect end was so perfect that everything about it is just perfect because that's what God does. With the livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth, you have that same refrain, according to their kinds, according to their kinds, according to their kinds, according to their kinds. Now that's really important. Now we get to understand why it's important. Okay? It's important because of verse 26. Now what does God make, how does God make man? He says, let us make man
in our image,
according to our
likeness.
Who has no other kind who is like him?
God.
God? Or, and his
man.
Image. There is no kind in the animals for man. There's no analogous kind. I always laugh when people say, tools are what separate us from the animals. That's not true, because there are animals that use tools. It's the image of God which separates us from the animals. The fact that we have a kind, and our kind is God. And whereas beasts of the field have a kind, and it's their own kind. And they don't have that same relationship to God as we do. Couple of things to note about being made in the image. An image is... there's a bunch of different facets to it, but I think this is the most notable one. When you were a king in the ancient Near East and you would go and conquer a different neighboring country, you would go to their capital city, and in the most important place in the capital city, what you would do is you would erect a big statue of yourself. And why would you potentially do that as a king? Who just conquered that territory.
This is mine.
It reminds the people around it who's in charge.
I'm in charge. Yeah, so that's an image. They would call that an image. That's what God is doing in his creation. In his world, he's setting up his kingdom, he's creating his kingdom, and then he puts in it his image, and he says, this is who's in charge. This person reflects my nature, and he is made in my own image, my own likeness, so that he is just like me. He's not God, but he's just like me. And that means that everybody will always remember, I'm in charge. This is the basis of why murder is so horrible. And you go to Genesis chapter 9, whoever shed man's blood by man, his blood shall be shed. For man was created in the image of God. So to assault another human being is to assault who?
God.
The same way that if you were, the native indigenous people who were conquered went up and you tore down that image, who are you really assaulting? You're assaulting the ruler, right? So that's what's happening here, is man is the authorized representative of God's rule over creation. This is the beginning of what we call God's mediatorial kingdom. God has a universal kingdom in that he is immediately and directly king over everything. But then he also has something called a mediatorial kingdom. Mediatorial comes from mediate, right? And mediate just means to do it through something or to do it through someone. So God intends to rule over the creation, but he wants to rule over the creation through mankind ruling over the creation. And he wants to demonstrate his power by actually doing that and doing it that way. Okay. Questions on that to this point? Okay, so this is the other thing that I want to mention about this beginning of this passage here. God said, okay, Then God, plural, said, singular, let us, plural, make, singular, man, plural, in our, plural, image, singular, after our, plural, likeness, singular. Okay, so you have this very intentional play off of the singular and off of the plural, and off the singular and off the plural. Why do you think that is, according to the context?
My first thought is Trinity.
Okay.
Just, I'm not necessarily right, but whenever I read it, I think we were made in the image, not just of this singular being, we were made in the image of a Trinitarian being, which has implications for fellowship and all these other things, but...
Yes. Yes. Now, you can't read this and say, this teaches the Trinity, because you don't have a decisive revelation of the Trinity until when? That is a revelation, but you can't really articulate the doctrine of the Trinity until who comes on the scene?
Oh, it was on
Jesus, right? The incarnation is the decisive revelation of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It really, technically, the revelation of the Trinity happens between on the page between Malachi and Matthew. Like that's where the Trinity
yeah.
becomes really clear, and then Matthew, Luke, you know, so they all explain that truth. But it's in seed form. This is what some scholars have called like the sensus pregnans, the pregnant sense. Like it's there, but it's just not out yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what's happening. Everything in creation must have a prototype within God. So the reason why beauty exists in the earth is because of God's beauty. The reason why justice exists in the earth is because God is just. The reason why we can love each other is because God is love. The reason why things are ordered in creation is because God is faithful. And all these other things. So the same thing is true for humankind. And what's the feature about humankind that's emphasized here? What does mankind have that no other animal in the story has had to this point?
The likeness of God.
They had the likeness of God. That's true. And that's absolutely true. That's not what I'm looking for. It's in verse 27. It's also to dominion, but it's also not what I'm looking for at this point. So verse 27, he created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him.
Male and female.
Gender. No other animals are said to have gender in Genesis 1. Why is that? Because mankind is unique. Mankind is different. Mankind is different in these four ways. First of all, the way that his creation is introduced, let us make, rather than, and God made, so it's personal. They're made in the likeness of God, and therefore they don't have a comparable kind in creation. Gender is also highlighted, and they also have dominion over the rest of creation.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of read in verse 22 where it says be fruitful and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the birds multiply on the earth. Like, doesn't that mean that they would have gender?
They do have gender. I'm not saying that they don't. I'm just saying that Moses doesn't mention it.
Okay.
So remember...
It's a category.
Yeah.
In verse 27
mm-hmm.
for gender.
Yeah. And it's not like... Everybody knows that there's a mommy bird and a daddy bird, you know, and a mama elephant and a daddy elephant, you know. But remember, Moses is not just reporting history. He's portraying history. He's telling it in a particular way to make a point. And so to this point, he hasn't made any point about gender, even though it's been assumed. Now you have male and female. You have male and female. Well, why? Because there's a plurality within humankind, which is an expression of the unity of the image of mankind. Okay, you have within humankind, you have unity, because we're all made in the same image, but you also have plurality, because we're all different. You have both. And that's seen in verse 27. So God created mankind, in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, singular. Male and female, he created them, plural. So the idea that, you know, I don't think this is teaching that, you know, male, you have a male and you have a female, and they're two halves of the image of God, and they come together and they're the image of God. No, mankind as a whole is created in the image of God. That image is expressed in a male way, and that image is expressed in a female way. And that both are necessary for the expression of the whole image of God, but as a group, not as necessarily in marriage. So you have unity and you have plurality. And that unity and plurality is actually really important to Genesis 3, because that's what gets interrupted. This is actually central to the whole idea of nakedness, is the unity and plurality expressed within marriage and the innocence that comes along with that. But this is so important, because what you have here is you do have the doctrine of the Trinity, and the doctrine of the Trinity is expressed in inkling form in the fact that there's a man and a woman, and they're both in the image of God, but they're not the same person. So that's why he says, let us make. It's because it has to do with the fact that there's a man and a woman who are both made in the image of God, not because Moses is necessarily trying to teach the Trinity. But it leads there. Does that make sense to everybody? That's really important to get for this, and it's going to be really important for later.
Yeah, I think if you give it an average person who, you know, has no Trinitarian doctrine, I've never heard of it, they've read through this, they probably wouldn't know that, but they know there's something about us. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's typically what, you know, the explanation would be,
mm-hmm.
until they read further on and they come to understand Christ coming in and start seeing, you know, the Holy Spirit, and then a lot of phone calls for
yeah.
So yeah, I think that's important to not just assume that that's what it teaches. I think if you hear when Dr. James White argue with or debate with some people, and the first people will bring this text and say, well, that doesn't teach about it. Trinity,
mm-hmm.
and he has to be able to rebuttal that, just like
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, male and female are used as imagery throughout the rest of the Bible too, in the sense of Christ and the church. So, the distinction, like all the other distinctions he's made, continue throughout the entire Bible.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we always use the argument that the reason why the woman submits to the man is because the man is the head of the woman, and the prototype of that is the fact that Christ is the head of man, and the prototype of that is the fact that God is the head of Christ. Right? That's straight out of 1 Corinthians 11. Well, that's Trinitarian thought, and that's coming from this. So, like, the fact that this really does end up in the Trinity is actually a really biblical thing. That's where it leads. That's where the Bible takes it. It's just that you gotta say what's true about the text that's in front of you, not make it mean more than it really does.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very important, especially when you teach the chronicle of redemption. If you get to this part and you talk about Trinitarian, the Trinity, some people that have no knowledge of the Bible, they look so confused.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, what are you people talking about?
And yeah.
When I just caution people, when you get to that part, just leave that alone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It also helps us appreciate how nuanced the Bible is.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't simplify things into these like nice creedal statements. It just puts it all out there at once and then says, just wait. I'll explain it in time. We need to appreciate that, and to appreciate how integrated the doctrine of the Trinity and all other major doctrines are into the whole fabric of Scripture, and that explaining it is not easy. And it takes time in order to go through it. That's why people come to the texts and say, well, I don't understand where the Trinity is in the Bible. And you kind of have to say, well, it's like it's all of it, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's the whole teaching of the Scriptures. And it takes work to get there. That's why it took 300 years to really formulate it in the Nicene Creed. Okay, we need to get to day 7, and since they're ending, I think I got 5 minutes. God blesses them. So you have the same thing. You have the augmentation of the good thing that's been created. Here's this perfect world, and I bless you to enjoy it perfectly. That's the idea of blessing. And related to that is, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion. So there's a difference between the blessing that was given to the birds and the fish, and the difference that was given to the mankind, is that the blessing of mankind includes dominion and subduing the earth. The word subdue is a very, like, it's not violent per se, but it's very aggressive. This is where we get the beginning of what we call the cultural mandate. There's a requirement for humankind to basically create culture. to take the world that God has made and use it to make things. So the fact that we drive cars and that we use cell phones and that we have books like this and that we have all the things that we have and we wear clothes and we have certain styles and we have certain systems of communication and thought, all of that comes from subdue the earth. Think about it. Read about it. Understand the world that I've created you. Go and create and be fruit, you know, be the creators that I intended you to be, because that's part of what it means to be in the image of God, is to go and do what God does. Part of that is creating. Now, we don't create out of nothing. We have to use the materials that he's made, and that's the big distinction. But within this, you have the very beginning of culture and invention and subduing the earth. This is why I love gardening. I'm really terrible at it, but I love gardening. Because I think to myself, I am subduing the earth. Earth, you will do what I say. And that is an exercise of my dominion over the earth. Now, of course, it doesn't do what I say, which is a reminder of the curse. But, like, that's the way that it was supposed to be, is that we would rule over the creation. This is also really important because We get our thinking backwards, especially when it comes to like environmentalism. We always say like, the earth needs man. Or we always see that man needs the earth. We need the earth, right? And that's true. Like, we were created to live in this environment. We can't live outside of this environment. It's not natural for us to live outside of this environment, so we need to take care of it. But the way that the scriptures present this is that the earth isn't complete until man is there. So really, it's that the earth needs the man. Abner Chow put it this way. He said, we say that man should be a tree hugger. Well, trees should be man huggers. Like, the creation is a man hugger. The creation comes to man and says, I love you, I need you, rule over me. And the creation is not complete without mankind there. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, birds of the sea, everything that moves on the earth. In verses 29 through 30, he says, your food is going to be plant life. There is an implication here that they were all vegans. Like, I don't know how else to put it. Like, there's no meat eating here. Now that's really important. You know, it's not just like something to laugh at, because it's actually theologically necessary. Like, why is that important that they're vegans?
Well, there's no death yet.
There's no death. Right? And what do you need to do in order to eat meat? You need to kill something, right? Now, that's not saying that meat eating is wrong, because you have it actually condoned in Genesis 9. But you have the whole idea of death is not part of the creation. And that, so the way that creation functioned mirrored that. And we were not created originally to eat meat, or at least it was not necessary. You shall have them for food, you also have a theology of food and eating that's introduced here. Mm-hmm. Eating becomes really important in what story?
Eve.
The fall, right? Took and
ate,
right? So that idea of eating is introduced here, and it's super important in the flow of the story. Okay, everything that he had made, and behold, it was not good, but very good. Tov ma'od, not just tov. Exceedingly good. And there was evening, morning, the sixth day. Okay, seventh day, we need to kind of barrel through this, but the seventh day is the point of the whole story. All right? Seventh day is the point of the whole story. We always say that day six is the point. Day six is not the point. Day seven is the point. How do I know that? Well, there's contrast between the rest of the story and this story, and this day. First of all, God does not say or make anything. There is no acting of God. He just rests, and he blesses, and he sanctifies, but there is no speaking, there is no making, there is no creation of anything new. So he's resting. Secondly, there is no, and it was so, because there was nothing made to be so. Thirdly, he sanctifies this day over the other days. So it's more important than the other days. And then fourthly, what formula is it lacking at the end of the day? And it was good, but there's also evening, morning, the seventh day, right? You're expecting that. So it's different. Remember, contrast is one way that we understand the point of a story. And so there's massive contrast happening here between days 1 through 6 and day 7. So it's way different, which means that this is the point. The emphasis here is it was finished, so it was complete, perfect, and all the hosts of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested. Now, rest, we usually think like taking a nap because you're tired, right? You know, is God tired? No. So what is the significance of rest? The significance of rest is more of like what we would describe as like relaxation, enjoyment. That's what rest means. Rest is something where there is this perfect enjoyment of creation, and God sits back and he admires what he's created and he perfectly enjoys it. That's the idea of rest here. Resting, when you relax, you're not creating anything new. You're just you're resting. So there's another significance in the fact that who has just been created on day 6 on the previous day? Mankind. And mankind is in God's image. And here God rests, which means that man is to rest. And the meaning of rest being?
Enjoy
God's creation perfectly. That was the original intention of man. There's perfect harmony between the earth and man. There's perfect accord between what happens in man's heart and what happens on the earth and what happens in God's heart. There is absolute peace, rest, perfection, wholeness, completion. And he rests on the seventh day. Now, does that mean that Adam does not work? No, because he's put in the garden to work and keep it. So work is part of that rest. Work was enjoyable. Work was interesting. Work was not difficult. It wasn't toilsome like it is now. It was completely different. That's introduced by the curse, which we'll get to when we get to chapter 3. But we are supposed to have rest. Now, that rest is supposed to be forever. How do I know that from the text? What's not there?
The next day or the ending part of the day.
Evening, morning, seventh day, right? Yeah. There's an eternal rest. There's no time limit on this one. So this is to be the state of creation forever, not just for the sixth day, or not just for the seventh day. It's not that there's this cycle. It's just that there were 6 days of work, and on the seventh day, God rested and enjoyed his creation, which he intended to do forever, because it was perfect and complete, and there was nothing left to do. Because you add to something that's perfect is to ruin it. Like if you have a perfectly seasoned meal, and you're just like, I think it needs more salt. You ruin the meal, right? When you add the salt. Okay, so I want to connect this to other parts. So when this rest is lost, when the fall happens, there's no more enjoyment and relaxation. It's lost. Adam toils, he sweats, there is difficulty. There is no relaxation, there's no enjoyment, because there's no harmony. Fast forward to Israel, and commandment number 4 is keep the Sabbath, right? Keep the Sabbath. Sabbath comes from 7, comes from rest, which the 7 and rest are very similar, actually. But like you have keep the rest. Well, why does God give them that command? What are they supposed to be presenting to the world in the seventh day? Right. We as a people are those people who stand for the way things were before the fall. Or another way to put it is we stand against the fall. We will mirror the fact that just like God rested on the seventh day in creation, we will rest from all our works by just resting and mirroring God and saying this is the way things always were supposed to be. not necessarily the cycle itself, but to say there's a day that lasts forever that was supposed to be restful and enjoyment, the way that creation was always made to be. So that's the point of the day of Sabbath. Now that gets linked up to the Exodus and coming into the land, and you have Psalm 93, they will not enter my rest, right? So the entering into the land was supposed to be where that rest was supposed to happen, but they weren't allowed to because of their sin. And you have so many connections between that and this. Now you fast forward to the New Testament, Hebrews 3 and 4, and you have there now remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. But that Sabbath rest is found in who? Jesus. And because it's found in Jesus, it's no longer actually being in a land and like a specific land, but that land is actually prototypical of the whole heavens and the whole earth. And that land is actually being restored by Jesus Christ, and we participate in that restoration of the earth and in the new heavens and the earth to by faith in his name, by resting from our works, just like God rested from his works. And that's where you have this rest. So the rest is where all of this is going, and in that rest you're going to have the context, which is going to come into Genesis chapter 2, which we'll start looking at next week. Are there any questions? We can hit them afterwards if there are any. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for the wonderful privilege it is to study your word. I pray that you would help us to let these things shape our worldview and to go out into the world and proclaim these things and to let them change our hearts and our minds. I pray that you would be kind and gracious to us and bring us to the new creation very soon. In your name we pray. Amen.